Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We are coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Marlene Even. The Bureau of Meteorology recently made headlines after their failed rebranding fiasco. They hope to be called by their full name, or the Bureau for short, instead of the well-known nickname of BOM. The spotlight then opened up a whole other can of worms, allegations that the organisation has been cautious when providing public commentary on climate change, an allegation the Bureau rejects. In other news, the CSIRO was criticised for a fracking information sheet sent to Indigenous communities that stated methane may play a role in climate change. The sheets were produced by CSIRO's Gas Industry Social and Environmental Research Alliance, which is partially funded by the gas industry. The CSIRO told ABC that this wording was an error not picked up by review and that they ensure independence and integrity of all its work. So this opens up a conversation. How do journalists report on the climate crisis when dealing with cautious sources? And should we demand that our public institutions be more brave and independent from the government of the day? So to discuss this and more, we are joined by Graham Redfern, environment reporter for The Guardian Australia. Welcome to Fourth Estate.
Hi, thanks. How are you doing?
And we're also joined by Alex Crow, environment reporter at The Canberra Times. Welcome.
Hi, Marlene. Thank you.
So you're both environment reporters. Have you noticed a change in people being more or less cautious to discuss climate change recently? Graham, I'll go to you first.
If we're talking about, are we talking about public officials, then obviously the story with the Bureau of Meteorology, I've been working on that for a week or so. I've definitely noticed the change over the years. I think I probably first started talking to the Bureau on climate stories maybe around 2006, 2007. And in those good old days, I could call a scientist directly, ask them for an interview, do an interview, write that up. What seems to have happened is, kind of in stages, it became, you don't really do that anymore. Can you please go to the media team? You would do that, but they would still get an interview. And then it was, can you write down the questions? And sometimes they would put a scientist up for you, but not always. And then probably the last couple of years, my experience has been that requests to the Bureau, if the Bureau thought that there was going to be a climate angle in there somewhere, more often than not, almost always, actually, I was refused an interview and was just given written answers. Sometimes they arrived to the deadline, sometimes they didn't. I should say, though, that if you're doing, I do some weather stories sometimes, it's very different. If I'm asking to interview a forecaster for current conditions or what's going to happen tomorrow, then I found the Bureau's quite responsive. But if there's an idea that there's going to be a climate angle in there, definitely my sort of practical experience has been that it shuts down pretty quick.
And Alex, have you noticed a change when approaching people to discuss climate change? Has there been a more or less cautiousness recently?
Similar experience to Graham in terms of the Bureau. They tend to put sort of colourful words around it, or avoid the conversation when if I'm asking a scientist or a meteorologist to comment on such a thing. But in terms of weather stuff now recently, we were at the Canberra Times, were once able to call the line here, and I was on first name basis with one of the meteorologists here in the ACT, because they were often reporting on the weather, and it used to be she'd pick up the call, pick up the phone, and would say what's coming, what this next weather system would mean. And then a few weeks ago, or a few months ago, sorry, that stopped happening. On the other end of the phone was, we've been told not to talk to you. Put it in an email, and we'll get a response from you. Even things like the weather, and that, like, obviously you can't wait a few hours for a response about the weather. It's changing too quickly, and sometimes it would be, I'd be asking for someone to talk me through reports that were coming through, analyses, and they'd point me to links on the website and say the information's here, and you know you're after an expert opinion and expert advice. But instead it was, we can get you an approved response, put it in an email, we'll get you a statement, which it just meant that we could no longer rely on them as a source of information, because it was too delayed in when we'd get any information back.
I think probably if you were to look at some of our weather stories, I don't know about you, Alex, but you'll see that they always used to, our weather stories always used to have a bureau forecaster quoted. But I'll bet you, if you look at the media exposure of someone like Ben Domenicino from WeatherZone, you would have started to see other forecasters from other organisations outside the bureau start to appear in stories. And there's a reason for that. It's because we couldn't always get a response from the bureau in a timely way.
Yeah, the same things happened here with our local radio station, who the ABC. They'd always have somebody on in the morning to talk about what was happening for the day from the bomb. And that has stopped happening, and it's been replaced with someone from WeatherZone or one of the other organisations. And I assume it's the same reason. It was just not getting it quickly and not getting the responsiveness that they required.
We do know from some of the reporting that I've done and other people have done in the last week that there's been an exodus from the communication space in the bureau. I've heard figures of more than 20, more than 30 staff leaving for all sorts of reasons or moving to different areas within the bureau. I can only speculate, but I think that you lose a bit of sort of institutional memory when that happens. I don't know of the experience of the staff that come in. I'm sure they're all really great and competent, but when you've got staff changes going at a level like that, it can't help to deliver to journalists the kind of timely response that you need. It must have had an impact.
And you've both spoken about this changing relationship between the media and the bureau. What are the trickle-down effects then in how you can provide quality journalism and a service to the public by this, as you described in your report, Graham, this accusations of the Bureau cowering in the corner of the climate crisis from former and current staff? How does that have a trickle-down effect in your ability to provide quality journalism?
I mean, I can give a specific example. This was earlier this year. There was a really interesting study in a journal called the Journal of Climate. I think there were about five authors of that study. Four of them were from the Bureau. It was a really interesting study. I came across it. I thought, this is great. It was about how the Bureau had developed this way to attribute the human impact on weather events that hadn't yet arrived, so they could basically take their forecast models and compare the model as it is now with the changed climate to a forecast model without it. That was a fascinating piece of work, and clearly a lot of work had gone into it. It appeared in quite an esteemed journal. But when I asked to interview any of the authors of that article, I was told no twice. I was just told by the Bureau that they were not able to, I think the words were, facilitate that today. Now, sort of what effect does that have on your reporting? Well, I mean, I still wrote the story, but you know, you want to be able to interrogate how the methodology behind something like that. You want to know kind of what the implications of it might be. And you want to kind of communicate that to your readers. And we couldn't do that. I mean, I managed to write a story. I got at it from a different angle. But I think broadly, the Bureau holds it holds the nation's sort of climate heartbeat, and has done for a long time. And when you can't sort of speak to the researchers and the scientists in the Bureau to hear from them on how things have changed and what their modeling tells us is coming, I think that actually has quite wide implications for how the Australian public perceives the threats of climate change and just how bad it is. I mean, what one former CEO, Rob Vertessi, told me in an interview last week that a story on a few days after that, he said that, you know, the Australian public probably doesn't really realise just how bad things are, and part of that is because of this sort of muted response from the Bureau and other government agencies too.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that I don't think it's the scientists that are not wanting to speak to us and not wanting to talk about climate change and not wanting to get these points across. You know, they're experts in this field. They're doing this work. They know what's happening. And if you do get that direct line, the conversation that comes from that is expert, and it is wonderful for our readers and wonderful as a journalist. But the fact is that you're being made to jump hoops, and then at the end, like Graham said, not actually getting the opportunity to speak to those scientists in the first place. So what you end up with is a written statement. And, you know, there's a time and a place for a written statement. But when you're talking about something that is, like, politically, you know, like, it's something as important and charged as climate change, like, you need to speak to somebody who's doing the research about this. Being pointed to a statement on a website is not beneficial for your readers, and it's certainly not beneficial for you trying to do your job.
It's interesting when you look at what some of the other national weather agencies in different countries, how they deal with climate change. I mean, I remember looking at the UK's Met Office when they had those crazy heat waves earlier this year. The officers at the Met Office were very front foot on communicating the role that climate change had played in this. It's the same in the United States at NOAA. And I spoke to a recently resigned staff member at the Bureau who said that they kind of look upon those agencies with envy, that they appear to be able to just speak to the science, speak to what they know, without this kind of political lens over the top of it all the time. Just because climate change has become politicized, it doesn't mean that the science is any less legitimate or that we should hear less about it. And I think that's a really, I can see how it's a difficult line to walk for some agencies. But I think that the environment that's been generated around climate change through sort of nearly a decade of coalition government has done quite a lot of damage.
And I mean, you mentioned there the influence of having a coalition rule for like a decade. We know that has had an influence for climate change being a heavily contested issue. With Labor winning and the huge wave of Teals coming into our parliament, is what we are seeing just an inertia in our institutions? In short, are they catching up with this fundamental change in our politics? Alex, I'll go to you.
Look, I hope so. I think there's already been a change of language with Tanya Plibersek as environmental minister. She is coming out and saying this is an effect of climate change much more frequently and regularly than we have heard in the past. I'm very lucky here in the ACT. When I go to a media conference, we have the Greens standing up quite often, and there is no hiding the fact that they believe, and I'm going to speak to environment ministers here, it's not, they're not shying away from the fact that climate change is an effect of many, many issues that we're talking about. And so here I've been lucky not to have been silenced reporting on local issues, not to have had that the coalition government sort of, yeah, not to have been affected here in the ACT. And I think it has already shifted in language federally as well.
Yeah, so the language definitely has shifted. And yeah, I think that's a good word, inertia. It almost feels like the climate election didn't happen. as far as the how from what I see, the Bureau of Meteorology's response, and just to sort of back in what Alex has said, I don't see any suggestion that scientists would not be really happy to talk to journalists and talk to the public about what they're finding. I think the issue just with the Bureau has been this kind of really quite rigid gatekeeping. And yeah, I would definitely back in what Alex has said there.
You're listening to Fourth Estate on the Community Radio Network. This week, we're talking about the media reportage of the climate crisis and the media's relationship with public institutions. I'm joined by Guardian Australia's Graham Redfern and the Canberra Times' Alex Crow. So then why do you think we have this level of cautiousness still? I mean, we've had the conversation around climate change changing in recent years. Why is there still this level of cautiousness to speak with the media about it, by public institutions or by agencies like universities broadly?
I think our public institutions are still catching up with the rest of the sentiment in Australia, because once upon a time people were, you know, denying that climate change was happening, and these loud, angry people still exist. And there's still this fear that you're going to get these important people offside and lose their vote and lose their confidence by scaring them. I think also there's a hesitancy that the, you know, dire warnings get old and get boring when it comes to universities, and they're talking about their research. They're worried that, you know, the same messages is getting lost if they continue to repeat it. So, but in terms of our public institutions, yeah, I think it's more about realizing that the Australian people now recognize that climate change is fundamentally affecting their life, and it's okay to say that, and they want to hear that, and we're not stupid, and people are ready to know what are you doing about it.
The way that public institutions has engaged with it, obviously, is like when you've got government agencies, for example. I think probably they have been they feel badly burned. When I interviewed one of the former CEOs of the Bureau, he said to me, this was a guy called Rob Vitesse, he said that no minister had ever said to him to behave in a particular way or tone things down on climate change. But he said that you get these signals that, like, back channel signals, that there are certain things that you shouldn't say and certain steps that you shouldn't take. And there's this understanding. And from a leadership perspective, he said that as consequences, if you get it wrong, you might be sidelined for consultations. You might get overlooked for budget requests. Obviously, the leaders of these agencies have this very difficult line to walk across. But I think with a science-based agency, I think that it's to be underplaying what the science is telling you is I want to say unforgivable. It's forgivable, but it has real knock-on implications. Who knows what some of the statements of the Bureau would be like if there was a different internal atmosphere around climate change. You know, there are leaders in these agencies that make decisions on how they want to engage with climate change. And as Alex said, I think for some it's just not caught up with reality. And that's a real shame. We can only hope that changes. But like I've been reporting on climate for a long time, and it's been politically and socially divisive, and I think some of that division has been spread deliberately. That's difficult for people working in the public service to engage with, but the science is the science. And I think that you can separate the political noise from the scientific realities. I'd like to think we're going to see more of that.
And then what are some of the practical ways that you can get over those roadblocks if the institutions that you want to talk with are a bit cautious to speak with journalists? How do journalists go about doing their jobs when they have those roadblocks set up in front of them? Alex, I'll go to you.
I think making sure that you have a wide range of sources and contacts to go to, and you understand what might be some of the agendas of different people working for different groups, and know what you're going to people for, and what you're likely to get from them if it is roadblocks, or if it is an agenda that they're pushing, and being able to make that very clear in your reporting. This person works for these people. This person is doing research that is sponsored by this. And also, I think if you've got something worthwhile that people want to respond to, even if there's a roadblock, then letting them know, look, otherwise we're going to publish this, and please, I want to give you guys a chance to give me the science, or give me your expert opinion, or what this means.
Yeah, and I think if you like, I know we're talking a lot about the Bureau, but if you know you're around and you know your way around the Bureau's website, a lot of the historical data on climate is available if you know where to find it. And there's a lot of climate researchers that use a lot of the Bureau's data. They're well across it. What I've done quite a few times is, if you can't speak to somebody at the Bureau, then you speak to another climatologist that works with the Bureau's data to speak about what they're finding. It's not ideal because you want to be as close to the source as you can with the people that you talk to. But if you can't do that, then you need to find the next best solution. And so it's about knowing your round, I think, and knowing who are the genuine experts here, who are working on this day to day, who know their way around the data. And that's how you do it. It's a bit more time consuming, but yeah, for a story like climate, it's important we do that.
Now, the recent CSIRO debacle over fracking highlights a problem that may be harder to budge than one about our institutions and how they do comms. How do we stop business interests hijacking the independence of our institutions?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I covered this in a column that I write a few weeks ago. If people aren't familiar with it, that the CSIRO has an industry, a gas industry project called GISERA. Don't ask me to remember what that stands for. They had produced some fact sheets about fracking and the risks around fracking. And one of those fact sheets said that methane may cause climate change, which is a bit like saying alcohol may get you drunk. There is no evidence that any nasty gas industry executive kind of rolled over the top of it and made them change the words or anything. But the problem that this creates is that it was such an obvious error that the public is aware that CSIRO, it's part of its operating model, is to go into partnerships with industry. And if they think that there's industry money involved, then you can see how that would erode public trust in the things that CSIRO are telling you. Is that unfair? I don't know, but it's certainly that's the perception. And that then does become really problematic. CSIRO is a big organization. They do a lot more, that they have a lot more projects than GISERA. But you can see how if those relationships with industry are not really well managed, that the public trust in those broader agencies could erode pretty quickly.
Yeah, I know the Guardian's done quite a lot of reporting on this recently, Graham. A wider problem of, I guess, the commercialization of CSIRO and where that leads them as our National Science Institute, if making money and it leads to the scrapping of of important projects, which again has been reported recently by The Guardian, with the climate forecasting program, and how do we rely on our National Science Institute when a commercialization and making money becomes an important outcome?
The recent media coverage that we've had of various public institutions, Bureau of Meteorology, CSIRO, and just this broader issue, does this erode the trust that the public and the media have of these organisations?
I think it's only natural when members of the public hear that there's a financial interest or a corporate interest in something that's going to erode people's trust. I think that's inevitable. I think that from a journalistic point of view, you've got to be able to put that information in front of your readers and let them decide. But not always. I think as well as journalists, you've got to take a view that at some point the interest becomes so pervasive that it's difficult to rely on something. If you've got other pieces of evidence from other sources that conflicts with a report or with a finding, then I think what we start to do as journalists is that we then have to start to report the inner workings of that to allow people to understand how these corporate interests can start to interfere in our understanding of environmental issues. It's been the case since Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and the DDT scandal in the United States. Whenever you have scientific findings that smash up against corporate interests, you will get interference. It happened with DDT. It happened with acid rain. It happened with fire retardants. It happened with asbestos. It happened with climate change. That makes our job as environment reporters really important, I think, but also really challenging. But I think that we've got to take that on, because as well as reporting the environment, the realities of what's unfolding in our environment and in our climate, we have to give people the context and the why, and the understanding of why is it that they understand things in a certain way. I'm kind of constantly on guard for corporate interference in that sort of information that we get given from wherever it comes from.
Yeah, I think approaching any source and any information with a little bit of distrust is not unhealthy, and being able to communicate that to readers is absolutely crucial. And you know, the value of having journalists that have been in the field for a long time and who have been working on the same issues for the same time, because they're able to find these connections and dig a little deeper than what couldn't look on the surface like a positive change and a progressive policy.
On that note, I'd like to thank Graham Redfern from Guardian Australia.
Thanks.
And Alex Crow from the Canberra Times.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening to the program. After the recording of this episode, we reached out to the Bureau of Meteorology. They've stated that sustained periods of severe weather conditions have required our team to conduct our communications at a greater than usual cadence. The Bureau responds to thousands of media inquiries each year across television, radio, print, and online. To read the full Bureau of Meteorology statement, head to the 2SER website. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. Thanks to our executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Marlene Even. Thanks for listening.